You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up, and as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my bill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the Moon.
Bruce Gagnon, our final speaker on the so-called National Missile Defense Program, is the National Coordinator for the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, based in Gainesville, Florida. He spoke earlier this month at Cornell University. Following his talk, we'll provide information on how to contact his organization and obtain educational materials and become involved in the worldwide campaign of resistance to the would-be masters of space.
I thought I'd start out with a few minutes just about myself. I think it's always interesting to know a little bit about your speaker. I grew up in a military family. My stepfather was in the Air Force, and we moved all over the place. I lived all over the world. I lived in Europe for 6 years and throughout the United States. And this was a very conservative family, Republican family. And in 1968, we were living in Florida, up in the panhandle of Florida, what's called actually Lower Alabama, because it's so conservative there. And I had my first organizing experience. I worked on the Nixon campaign as the vice chair of the Okaloosa County Young Republican Club. And it was, I did such a good job on that campaign that when Strom Thurmond came to town to do a fundraiser for Nixon, they had me sit at the head table with him as my reward for my hard work. So these were my early roots as a person and as an activist. And then in 1971, I joined the Air Force during the Vietnam War. Although I flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury to my elbow, and I had to get a waiver to get into the military at a time when everyone else was trying to get waivers to get out. And this actually was my first personal contact with the peace movement, as I had to take a bus from one place to another to get this waiver. And on the bus were all these guys, hippies, you know, trying to get out. And here I was, this very straight-laced young Republican, trying to get in. But these guys were very nice, and I was a little concerned they would be very judgmental of me and everything. And I found them to be quite warm. And so I think that had a lot to do with my being open to these peaceniks, if you will. But then I got sent to this base in California, the Travis Air Force Base, it was called. It was the airlift base for the war in Vietnam. GIs would come from all over the United States, get on airplanes at Travis, and go to Vietnam. And then when they would come back, these planes, they would bring the body bags. And almost daily, right across the street from my office, you look out the big windows, and on the runway, you'd see these rows and rows and rows and rows of body bags lined up. And my first roommate in the barracks, as it turned out, when I checked into the orderly room to get my room assignment, they looked down this clipboard and said, "Oh my God, we've only got one room left, but we'll get you out of there as soon as we can." Come to find out, we opened the door to go in, and there are anti-war posters all over the wall. This guy was the leading organizer in the barracks of the GI resistance movement there on the base, and most nights of the week, there's a knock on the door, and people would come in, white guys would come in with chairs and sit in a circle and talk about the war. Another night, knock on the door, and black guys would come in. They were Black Panthers from the cities, and they'd talk about racism. And I'm sitting in a corner thinking, you know, these are communists, you know. But slowly, within a few months, you know, this stuff started wearing me down, you know. And before long, I'm reading their books and joining the circle and beginning to participate in the discussion. And before you know it, I'm off and running. So I tried to get out as a conscientious objector, but they asked me what my history was. And, of course, it was all on the other side, so they wouldn't let me out. And so I did 3.5 years, what I called hard time, because it was, for me, very hard. And when I got out, I was going to school, and I got recruited from college to become an organizer for the United Farm Workers Union, Cesar Chavez, his union. And I started organizing fruit pickers in Florida into the Farm Workers Union. And that led me into the peace movement, where I worked for 15 years as the state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. And because of Cape Canaveral's presence in our state, we were very much involved in what was going on with the space program. You might have heard about the Cassini campaign that carried plutonium on board. I organized that campaign that was launched in 97 with 72 pounds of plutonium. So I've been at this for some time, so I want to share with you what I've learned about what's going on with the space program. What I'm going to show you are largely Pentagon documents and documents from the aerospace industry, primarily from Space News and Aviation Week and Space Technology, two of the more prominent industry publications. This is the headquarters of the U.S. Space Command, the military command that's been put in charge of developing U.S. control and domination in space. And their headquarters is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And here on the building, you see this logo that they have, Master of Space. In fact, they even wear that as a patch on their uniform. I like to call it Master of Disaster. But before I go forward, I want to actually go back. I want to go back to World War II, to Hitler's Germany, to his brilliant scientist, Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist that was creating the V-1 and V-2 rockets for Germany. Von Braun was a SS member, and he had a facility up in northern Germany right along the Baltic Sea called Peenemünde. And at Peenemünde, the Nazis brought in thousands of Jews and other prisoners of war to become slaves to actually build the V-1 and V-2 rockets for the operation. And the Allies began bombing Peenemünde. And so the Germans said, we have to move to a more secure location. And down in sort of central Germany, there's a mountain chain called the Harz Mountains. And inside that mountain, the Harz Mountains, they had a big tunnel in there that they had been storing military equipment and fuel. And so they moved the operation into the mountain itself, and they called it Mittelwerk. And right outside of Mittelwerk, they created a new concentration camp called Dora. And to Dora, they brought over 40,000 Jews, gypsies, prisoners of war, even a black American GI that had been captured. And they were sent there as slave laborers to go inside the mountain every day and build the V-1 and V-2 rockets. But soon enough, these workers began to sabotage these rockets. They were leaving screws unturned, urinating on the wires, and so when von Braun and his team would launch the rockets, they were going haywire. And so von Braun sent his team in to find out who the hell is sabotaging those rockets. And they identified 200 of these slaves and summarily hung them inside the mountain in front of everyone as an example that you will not do this to the operation. Well, eventually the Allies even closed in on this place too. And von Braun and his team scattered to the hills. And so when the Allies arrived, one of the first of the soldiers to arrive was a former governor from this state by the name of Hugh Carey. He was 18 years old when he arrived. And he tells a story that when they arrived there, they found thousands and thousands and thousands of bodies laying at their feet, waiting to be shoved into the crematory ovens. And they learned that 25,000 of the 40-some thousand, primarily Jews that were at Dora, perished there building these rockets for the Nazis.
Well, you know, after the war, the Allies created the Nuremberg trials, where they brought to justice the Nazi war criminals for their crimes against humanity. But there were about 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists that never went to trial. They were brought to the United States in violation of U.S. law under a program called Operation Paperclip. And about 200 of them, von Braun and his team, including 100 of his V-2 rockets, were sent to Huntsville, Alabama. And von Braun there became, right after the war was over, after NASA was created during the Eisenhower administration as a civilian agency to explore the heavens, von Braun was named as the first director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center at Huntsville, Alabama. The man that was in charge of the V-2 rocket testing program, Kurt Debus, became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center when NASA was created during that same time. And the man that was a base commander at Peña Mundi, Major General Walter Dornberger, became vice president of Bell Aerosystems Corporation here in New York. And actually, they made their big money during the Vietnam War building the helicopters for the war. And the man that was in charge of production at Middlework inside the mountain tunnel, the guy that cracked the whip on the slaves and kept them moving, kept them producing, Arthur Rudolph, became the project director for NASA's Saturn V rocket program that took the United States to the moon. So these are the origins of the U.S. space program. And you know, I can't help but wonder as to the similarity between that Nazi slogan, Deutschland über alles, and this Space Command slogan, Master of Space. They say that the Persian Gulf War was the first space war, that with U.S. satellite supremacy, we pre-identified all of Saddam Hussein's military targets in advance, and in the first 2 to 3 days of the war, bombed over 95% of those targets, leaving just a tiny sliver of capability that Saddam Hussein could then think he was fighting a war. And over the remaining weeks of the war, we used 100 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece, tested out new laser weapons, stealth bombers, and other so-called smart bombs. And at that time, Charles Horner was the commander of the Space Command, and he says, we came out of the war deeply sensitized to the value of space. Future military success, they said, will depend on space capabilities. So they learned that whoever controls space will win the wars on the Earth below. And they say in this news release from the Space Command that the recent Kosovo war with Yugoslavia was the second space war. And they say any questions about the role or effectiveness of the use of space for military operations have been answered by NATO's Operation Allied Force. And come to find out in that war, we tested a whole new weapon system called the computer. That with our satellites, we were able to actually take our computers and infiltrate Yugoslavia's computers, destroying their command control capability so that when our bombers flew over Belgrade, dropping bombs on civilian targets like hospitals and television stations and things like that, that they had virtually no capability to shoot them out of the sky because we had preemptively, via computer, destroyed their command control capability. And we also destroyed their national banking records by this computer technology. And today, we are destroying Osama bin Laden's banking records all over the world where he has bank as well. So former President Clinton has put the Space Command in charge of this new program, what they call computer network attack. And he told them, go out and find the very best high school computer geniuses in America, give them college scholarships, and bring them to work for the U.S. Space Command on this computer network attack program. Well, by the year 1996, they had a new commander at the Space Command. Here they have this headline, the U.S. Space Command prepares for future combat missions in space. And by this time, General Joseph Ashy had become commander of the Space Command. And he says, it's politically sensitive, but but it's going to happen. Some people don't want to hear this, and it sure isn't in vogue, but absolutely, we're going to fight in space, we're going to fight from space, and we're going to fight into space. The Space Command, General Esche said, will be a growing command, big time. And very recently, the Pentagon has come out with a new report talking about how they will dominate in space during the time of war. It's called Premises for Policy, Maintaining Military Superiority in the 21st Century. And I want to quote to you from the report. It says, the Pentagon must invest in the means to neutralize space assets, both commercial and military. Now, this is a very important point. For the first time, the Pentagon is now saying that they have the right to decide if another country's commercial space assets, in other words, their commercial satellites, are military targets. And if we so deem that they are, then we can destroy them. We have the right, the Pentagon has the right to do that. And they say, very importantly, in order to do this, in order to neutralize and selectively deny access to space, the Pentagon must have the means to control, the means to do this, the means to destroy these space assets. The weapons, in other words, to carry this out. Well, you know, we've been told that missile defense is to protect us from attack by madmen around the world, by rogue states, okay? Someone might want to attack the United States, and therefore we have to create this shield to protect us, this idea that a bullet would hit a bullet in space, knocking out any attack. Somebody tries to launch a missile at the United States, we'd have our interceptor go up and destroy it in deep space. But I would submit to you that already hearing just this little bit of what they're saying, that this idea of missile defense is a Trojan horse. It's a way to sell the American people on this whole idea of putting weapons in space for space control and domination. Because they know they can't come to the American people and say, give us hundreds of billions of dollars so that we can control and dominate space. They know they can't get away with that. Of course, you know, the Russians are very upset about this. They're saying that this will violate the ABM Treaty of 1972 that outlaws these kind of systems. And they say that if we go forward with deployment of this system, all bets are off, all negotiations are off. Forget any future reductions in nuclear missiles, that we will build more, they say, in order to overwhelm any system that you put up. And the Chinese, of course, are saying similarly that they, who today only have 20 nuclear warheads capable of hitting the United States, they say you will force us to build more. But China has been going to the UN's Conference on Disarmament in Geneva for the past several years, asking the United States to join them in signing a global ban on weapons in space. Today, there are supposedly no weapons in space. There's no better time than now to sign such a ban. Close the door before the horses get out of the barn. But the United States refuses. And so last November of 2000, for the second time, a resolution was brought to the floor of the General Assembly by Canada and Russia and China, calling for such a global ban. And the vote was 160-0-3. Everybody in favor, nobody opposed, three abstentions, the United States and Israel and Micronesia. I can't figure out why Micronesia. But the United States' official position is there are no weapons in space, therefore there is no problem, therefore there is no need to negotiate. This is a Space Command document called Vision for 2020. You see the laser firing and hitting targets on Earth. Let's look at some of the language in here. First, they say, let's take a historical perspective. Military forces, they say, historically have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. I want you to hang on these words. Hang on to these words, interests and investments, and military and economic. We're going to come back to them later on. During the rise of sea commerce, they say, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. So after Columbus went out looking for the New World for Queen Isabella, he comes back and says, I've discovered it. There's nobody there. This new place, it's all yours. And so Queen Isabella, of course, begins over this next 100 years the creation of the Spanish Armada. that really creates the whole global war system as the other European countries also begin to build navies, as they all go out and compete with each other for the new world. And pretty soon they're all cutting each other's throat, vying for control and domination in the new, in the, this new sphere. And so the Space Command says, likewise, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests and investments in the space medium due to their increasing importance. And they say in the future, because of corporate globalization, there will be a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots around the world. As people are working for corporations for a couple dollars a day, they're going to begin to kick up. And they say, you know, we can't put a Marine on every single street corner of the world. But with space control and domination in place, we will intervene anywhere at any time. Space superiority will emerge as an essential element of battlefield success in future warfare. And here they go on to actually define some of these terms. Here they talk about dominating the space dimension, and they define control of space. Control of space, they say, is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations within space, and most importantly of all, the ability to deny others the use of space. So we, 5% of the world's population, will be the master of space, denying other countries. Who do we think we are? This is from a Space Command document called Guardians of the High Frontier. It's where we operate. And they say there are three layers of orbit: lower Earth orbit, middle Earth orbit, and higher Earth orbit. And it's kind of like a parking lot at a grocery store. When all the lots, when all the spaces in the parking lot are full, nobody else can get there, right? Well, it's the same way in the orbits around the Earth. There are only so many spaces. So what these guys are now doing is beginning to put in place military satellites in each of these places, so much that one way you deny other countries access to space is you fill up the parking lot before they do. A few years ago, we had a global network meeting in Colorado at a time when they have a big annual convention of all these guys from the Space Command. And they were all wearing a patch that day as we were protesting outside. They were wearing a patch on their uniform that proudly said, "Take up space." But because of all these satellites they're now putting up, they also need what they call downlink facilities. So the Space Command has set up units all over the world. These are what are called receiving stations. So as the satellites orbit the Earth and beam their information down below, these receiving stations or downlink facilities get the information in what's called real time, split second time. They then process it and send it on to Buckley Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado, in real time, split second time, and then it is then processed and sent on to headquarters in Washington, D.C. And so one of our strategies in the global network has been, since our founding in 1992, has been to go to as many of these places as we can all over the world to begin to talk to people about the need to build a global resistance movement to stop this. Because we don't think that the peace movement in the United States can stop this by ourselves. We think there has to be a whole global movement to do so. So we try to visit as many of these places, organize demonstrations, organize meetings like this in order to build this movement. And that's where our membership has really grown from. We now have 150 affiliates from all over the world. One of the satellites you're most familiar with is GPS, Global Positioning Satellite. They say this has civilian application. If you're a hiker and you're lost in the woods, you can use your little GPS receiver to find your way home. Or if you're sailing on your yacht, you can use your GPS receiver. But GPS, built by Lockheed Martin, is fundamentally about war fighting. GPS coordinated the Persian Gulf War. GPS directs all nuclear weapons attacks. One of the other satellites that's up there now, also made by Lockheed Martin, is called MILSTAR. MILSTAR, they say, communicates with the war fighter. So whether you're a troop on the ground, or in a tank, or in a boat, or on a plane, all warfare on the Earth is now coordinated from space. So again, whoever controls space wins the wars. You become the Übermeister of the planet below. One of the most famous of all these downlink facilities is in England, northern England, up in Yorkshire. It's called Menwith Hill. It's a U.S. base, and they have 20 of these radoms, these big radar facilities. And now they're building two more for participation in the whole Star Wars program. But there was a women's peace camp out there for some time. You might remember the Greenham Common peace camps in the 80s in England. Well, after those campaigns were over, a lot of those women moved to Menwith Hill. And they set up a peace camp. And at night, they used to cut a hole in the fence and go into the buildings, break into the buildings, break into the file cabinets, and steal documents. And they were able to show that the United States has been spying on the people of Europe from Menwith Hill, intercepting all email, fax, and phone communications. And recently, about 3 or 4 months ago, 60 Minutes did a show about Menwith Hill, talking about the industrial espionage that's been going on from there. The United States has been intercepting European corporation bids against American corporations. And so the European Union today is holding hearings about the U.S. industrial espionage going here. And outside of 60 Minutes, it's not really been reported in the United States. In order to make Star Wars work, they have to do radar upgrades at another place up in northern England, up there in Yorkshire. This one's called Fylingdales. It's actually out in the Moors, which is a national park. This thing is out in the middle of there. In addition to this one, there's a radar in Thule, Greenland that has to be upgraded in order for Star Wars to come online. And Denmark controls Greenland's government. So there's been a major effort to try to get the Danish government to say no to the upgrade, and that will help slow this whole program down. And there are other upgrades around the world that are also important as well. One of the new satellites that is now being built, it's not yet been launched, is called SBIRS. SBIRS will be very much involved in this whole new Star Wars program. SBIRS stands for Space-Based Infrared System, and they say it will provide the essential high ground advantage of space-based infrared surveillance to the warfighter of the 21st century. Well, earlier I showed you a slide about national missile defense, the idea of having this bullet hit a bullet in space. National missile defense, they say, would protect the continental United States from attack. They'd deploy 100 of these interceptors in Alaska initially. They say a second deployment of 100 more will go into North Dakota. And they say there's possibly even going to be a third 100 more go into Maine to protect the east coast of the United States. But that's only one part of this program. And we have to be careful when we're talking about missile defense that we don't just talk about national missile defense. There's a very important component of it all called theater missile defense. Theater missile defense, the idea is to forward deploy these systems into regions of quote-unquote hostility, like the Middle East, where we are now deploying them with Israel, or into the Asian Pacific region. Theater missile defense is made up of three components: air, land, and sea. And I want to describe each one. The sea-based component is an Aegis destroyer, which is home-ported in Japan. And they would be outfitted with systems that would fire. They would get right up along shore, right up alongside the shore of the so-called offending country. And they would fire right after their rocket was launched and hit it in what's called its boost phase, immediately after it's launched. They say it'll be easier to pick it up then and easier to get it. You don't have problems with decoys and all that kind of thing at that point. The other is ground-based systems. These are the kind that U.S. is now deploying in Israel. These ground-based systems would be driven around on trucks, and they too would hit the missile immediately after it was launched. And the third system, run by the Air Force, is called the Airborne Laser. It's a converted Boeing 747 flying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a laser on its nose. And its job would be, again, to hit the missile immediately after it was launched in its boost phase. And so the vision of theater missile defense then is you could move right up close to that place and contain it, fully contain it, have it fully under control. You know, I've been trying to figure out, though, why they're so anxious, because for the last 6 months, they've been talking about moving theater missile defense into the Asian Pacific region. All kinds of talk about it. Senator Joe Biden from Delaware, a Democrat, came out against national missile defense, said it was evil, immoral, everything else, you know. But he said, we got to have theater missile defense on ships made in my state, you know. But deployed in Asia because it's such a, you know, dangerous place. And I'm thinking, what's, you know, what are these guys talking about? What's, you know, North Korea? But North Korea, you know, they've suspended their missile testing program. They don't have one missile capable of hitting the United States today. They're talking about reunification with South Korea. Who are we going after there, all right? So recently I saw this article in the Washington Post, May 26, 2000. For the Pentagon, Asia moving to the forefront. Let me read two paragraphs to you. When Pentagon officials first sat down last year to update the core planning document of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they listed China as a potential future adversary, a momentous change from the last decade of the Cold War. This new orientation is reflected in many small but significant changes. More attack submarines assigned to the Pacific, more war games and strategic studies centered on Asia, more diplomacy aimed at reconfiguring U.S. military presence in the area. The article goes on to say that we're essentially going to double our naval presence in the Pacific, that we're now expanding our runways on Guam and Wake Island, lengthening and widening those runways to handle the B-1 and B-2 bombers, and we are forward deploying cruise missiles into Guam now, today. And recently, just a month ago, the U.S. Space Command ran a practice computer simulation space war game, and the target was China. And now they're talking about deploying theater missile defense systems into the Asian Pacific region, beginning the encirclement of China. You know, Russia used to be the enemy, but now its economy has fallen apart. NATO is now expanding and basically militarily surrounding Russia. So Russia is under lockdown. They're not a problem anymore. But who's the one independent actor in the world today that is still outside the U.S. international global corporate control? China. And so what we are now talking about doing is deploying theater missile defense on our unsinkable aircraft carrier, as we call Japan. We're talking about deploying it in South Korea. We're talking about deploying theater missile defense in Taiwan. You know, when Nixon recognized China, he created what was called the One China Policy. He said the United States will not get involved in the dispute between China and Taiwan. It's an internal problem. And he said we will not sell weapons to Taiwan because that will only increase tensions. But Clinton lifted the ban on arms sales to Taiwan. The United States is now selling major weapon systems to them. And we are talking about deploying theater missile defense systems into Taiwan. Only 90 miles off the coast of China. I don't know if you saw that new movie out, 13 Days, the Kevin Costner movie. If you haven't, you should, about the Cuban Missile Crisis, how we almost went to war with Russia when they tried to put missiles 90 miles off our coast into our sphere of influence. But today we're talking about doing the same thing. And what's the problem? And, you know, right before the recent election, former Secretary of Defense Cohen went to China. And on his way back, he stopped in Australia. And he told the Australian people that you will help us pay for theater missile defense because if we go to war with China over Taiwan, we're going to need your help. And he told them, we want to build a theater missile defense test facility in Western Australia, and you're going to have to help us pay for it. You know, I want to read to you a paragraph out of this newsletter. It's the Catholic social justice newsletter called Network Connection. The particular headline issue in this is Dominance Over Diplomacy, about how the United States is moving away from international treaties like the ABM Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 at the UN that says nobody can put weapons of mass destruction in the heavens. We're moving towards this idea of dominance. And so in here it reports on a recent conversation between House Majority Whip Tom DeLay, Republican from Texas, they say one of the most powerful people in Congress. He's bragging to reporters about how he recently confronted the ambassador of China when they both appeared on the TV program Meet the Press. DeLay reached out and grabbed the ambassador's hand as if to shake it, but instead squeezed it as hard as he could and yanked the ambassador up close to him and sternly warned him not to underestimate the resolve of the American people. DeLay bragged about how he saw the ambassador's prompt departure from the TV show as a victory for American strength. So coming on the heels of the accidental U.S. bombing of the Yugoslavian embassy, and now the beginning encirclement of China with theater missile defense systems, we have the humiliation of the ambassador of China on national television. How are they to respond? And so in the long-range plan of the U.S. Space Command, they give us their final vision for the Earth. The Earth fully under control with the new space-based infrared satellites, cyber satellites, with the space-based laser in place, and with the successor to the shuttle. NASA is now talking about the military space plane that they say will be the successor to the shuttle, only doing civilian applications. But of course, you see in this graphic, very much involved in warfare in space, the Earth under control, the United States, the master of space. In 1989, I organized a demonstration, one of many, at the Kennedy Space Center. And our speaker that day was Edgar Mitchell, Apollo astronaut, fifth man to walk on the moon. And he came that day and he said, if we allow the Pentagon to put weapons in space, to even test weapons in space, we will create so much space junk that we will not be able to get off the planet Earth. Today, there are 110,000 pieces of space junk orbiting the Earth at 18,000 miles an hour, larger than a half an inch, being tracked on the big radar screens at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. And of course, if we increase that, he says, Mitchell said, we will be entombed to this planet. You know, 100 years ago, we viewed the rivers and the lakes and the oceans as vast and limitless. It didn't matter what we threw into them, industrial sewage, raw pollution, you know, and everything else, raw sewage. It didn't matter because dilution was the solution to pollution. But now we know better, right? And now that's the way we view space. It's vast, it's limitless, it doesn't matter what we do up there. But now the chickens are coming home to roost. This particular graphic points to this spec. It says this is one of 34 nuclear reactor cores that will fall back to Earth in the next 1,000 years. That since the beginning of the space program, the United States and Russia launched military satellites powered with plutonium and/or uranium orbiting the Earth. There have been several accidents from both countries, satellites falling back, burning up, and spreading their toxic contamination around the planet. And now we know that 34 of these are going to fall back, and when they re-enter, they're going to burn up and spread their plutonium and uranium globally to be ingested by the people into our lungs, where we'll receive leukemia, and then go down into our reproductive organs, where it'll be passed on for generation after generation. And this is why we oppose both the nuclearization and the weaponization of space. You remember earlier I asked you to hang on to those words, interests and investments. We're going to talk about them now. This is a book by a NASA scientist, Mining the Sky, Untold Riches from the Asteroids, Comets, and Planets. They say there's gold in them there hills. There's gold on the asteroids. There's magnesium and cobalt and uranium on Mars. There's helium-3 and water on the moon. And whoever gets to these planetary bodies, controls them, will be rich beyond compare. The only problem, the author says, is that today launch costs are too expensive to make this mining profitable. And so NASA's number one job today is to lower launch costs. This is a New York Times article from 1995, Who Will Mine the Moon? I ask you to take the word mine out and in its place put in the word own. The author says, will the moon become the Persian Gulf of the 21st century? Would helium-3, they say, could be used for fusion power and make the sheikhs of Arabi look like paupers? But you know, there's a problem. There's that moon treaty of the United Nations that says no individual, no corporation, no country can own the moon. Nobody can claim ownership of it. Nobody can put any military bases on the moon. And so you might recognize this name, Harrison Schmitt, former astronaut. He's a geologist by trade. He's created a corporation that wants to go and mine the moon. And he says that we got to get rid of this moon treaty. It's not a wise idea. The strong prohibition on ownership of natural resources causes worry, he says. And so these guys have gone out and found a congressman, Dana Rohrabacher, a right-wing Republican from Southern California, to introduce legislation to allow American corporations to circumvent the Moon Treaty. This legislation is not yet passed, but they're working on it today. Now, let me ask you all a question. Have any of you heard that we're going to Mars to look for the origins of life so that we might understand where we come from? Has anyone heard that? Yeah? Well, it's a lie. We're going to Mars because we want to mine Mars. And in this article, they say that by the year 2016, NASA intends to set up a human mining colony on Mars, powered with two nuclear reactors, launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida, on rockets with 10% failure rates. But because of the last two Mars missions that were failures, the Mars orbiter that was doing the mapping of the planet crashed into the planet, something they said Cassini never could do when it was doing its flyby of Earth with 72 pounds of plutonium on board. But anyway, because of those last two missions, this date has now been kicked further back. But they're still moving forward. The future missions for the Mars will be continued mapping. And then they're going to do a series of landers that are going to be powered with plutonium to drive around Mars, begin doing soil identification and soil sampling. And then they're going to do a series of missions of soil extraction. And then they're going to do a mission soil return back to Earth. And then they hope to be able to set up the actual mining colonies. You know the International Space Station, they say, is being built just above the planet Earth. On a clear night when it's all finished, they say, you'll actually be able to see it. It'll be like a star. And so originally, the International Space Station was going to cost $10 billion, start to finish. But now the price tag has gone up to $100 billion. So it went from $10 to $100 billion, right? Just right above the Earth. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, there must be some money in these Mars missions because they've got a whole series of them and they're promoting it everywhere. There's been Mars movies lately. They've even got this candy bar called the Mars Bar. You ever heard of that, you know? So, it works, you know, but anyway, I'm trying to find out what's the collective cost of these Mars missions, but I can't find that information anywhere. So, but a year and a half ago, though, I find out there's this conference at Cape Canaveral called Space Congress, organized by NASA, the industry, Air Force, all these players, and so I go, and they have a workshop on Mars, and I said, maybe, you know, I can go in there and find out what's, you know, what the dollar figure is for these. So there's about 100 people show up for the workshop, and a guy gets up in front, and he's not a scientist. He's a concessionaire. He's the guy that runs the Kennedy Space Center tours facility. And I'm saying, what in the world does he know about Mars? What is he going to, you know, how's he going to do a Mars workshop? Well, he gets up and says, we get 2.5 to 3 million visitors a year to the Kennedy Space Center tours facility, most of whom are children. And by the year 2020, they're going to be taxpayers. And we want to make sure they support these Mars missions. Right? Well, he doesn't go on to talk about the cost. But thanks to my trusty subscription to Space News, just a few months later, in July of 99, they come out with an editorial saying Mars missions are affordable. And they say that early estimates for the Mars missions quickly ran up to $400 billion. But they say Congress cut funding, but now the funding is back on track. They're moving forward again. And they say they also have the answer how they're going to pay for these expensive Mars missions.
Very good of them to figure that out. They say many agencies run popular entitlement programs where there's plenty of pork and fat to cut. Now, I don't know about you, but after the years of Reagan and Bush and even Clinton, which entitlement programs are they talking about? The only four that I know that are left are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and AFDC, which is welfare, what's left of welfare. And welfare now has a four-year limit in your entire life. You can only draw welfare for 4 years. So these are the programs that these guys suggest that they cut in order to pay for these Mars missions. Well, I've coined a phrase to describe this. I call it pyramids to the heavens. The aerospace corporations are the new pharaohs of our age. And build these pyramids, and we, the taxpayers, will be the slaves to pay for them. You know, they have one more problem about getting to Mars. They say it takes a year to get there. And with conventional rocket technology, a year, by the time they get there, because of space radiation, astronauts' bodies will be like jello. So they say, we got to get there quicker. So they've come up with this ingenious idea of a nuclear rocket to Mars with nuclear reactors for engines. Until today, at the University of Florida, where I live in Gainesville, Florida, the Nuclear Engineering Department is working with Los Alamos out in New Mexico, the DOE laboratory, to build the nuclear rocket to Mars. That also, by the way, they say will have military application as well. And recently, the DOE, Department of Energy, has announced that because of growing demand for space nuclear power, that they have to expand production for plutonium, the processing, the creation of plutonium at their facilities. And so they are going to expand production in Tennessee at Oak Ridge Labs and in Idaho at the INEL facility in order to meet the growing demand for space nuclear power. Well, you know, it's always been our position. We organized campaigns in 89 and 90 and 97 against NASA plutonium launches. And our position was it's not just that there might be a launch accident. The processing of this stuff is going to kill people just like it did during the bomb-making years, okay? And just to give you an illustration, Cassini that was launched in 97 with 72 pounds, during the years of 94 to 96 at Los Alamos in New Mexico, when they were fabricating the plutonium generators for Cassini, the Santa Fe, New Mexican newspaper reported that there were 244 cases of worker contamination during those 2 years of plutonium processing and fabrication. And just 2 or 3 months ago, right before he left office, former Secretary of Energy Richardson announced that five workers at Los Alamos were contaminated while building plutonium generators for future space missions. So we're going to see a whole industry develop around this whole thing, a whole new wave. This is a book written by John Collins, commissioned by Congress. He's a congressional staffer. They asked him to go out and write the definitive study on what are we going to need, what's it going to take for us to control space. Military space forces the next 50 years. And you know how the foreword of a book is signed by people who say, this is great, we really recommend it, hope you'll read it. Look at some of these names you might recognize. John Glenn, John Kasich from Ohio, Volkmer from Missouri, Bill Nelson from Florida, used to be the congressman from Cape Canaveral, went up on the space shuttle. He's now the U.S. Senator from Florida. But when I saw these two names right here, Ike Skelton and John Spratt, I was just shocked. You know who they are? Well, April of 1999, I'm watching C-SPAN. I watch it as often as I can. They're having the debate in the floor of the House of Representatives on national missile defense. The question, do we deploy as soon as technologically feasible, yes or no? And the vote that day was 345-71 in favor. Well, you know, the House and the Senate are so evenly divided. In order to get a 345-71 margin, it takes a lot of Democrats to support it. And by the way, in the Senate, the vote was 97-3 in favor of deployment as soon as technologically feasible. But that day, these two Democrats, Ike Skelton from Missouri and John Spratt, Democrat from South Carolina, led the floor fight for ballistic missile defense deployment as soon as technologically feasible for the Democratic Party. Well, in this book, the author says, there's a thing called the Earth-Moon gravity well.
says it's like a wishing well. Imagine somebody standing at the top of a well. You control who gets in and out of the well. Or it's like the front gate at a military base. Whoever controls the gate controls who gets on and off the base. And so they say, with the author says, that with U.S. bases on the moon and with armed space stations at the L4 and L5 positions, we will be able to control who gets on and off the planet Earth. And the author goes on to say that our armed forces could lie in wait at that location and hijack rival shipments upon return. So if anyone else tried to go out and mine the sky and they were not authorized, we'd hijack them on the way back. NASA, by the way, has said that once they get the mining operations all squared away, once they get launch costs lowered and they get everything going, they're going to privatize it all, turn it over to the aerospace industry. And you, the taxpayers, would have paid all the years of research and development, and when it's time to make money, they'll turn it over to these guys, and then these guys will use the Space Command as their instrument for control, as Queen Isabella used the Spanish Armada to protect her interests and investments in the New World. And they say in this book, the author's fundamentally important, nuclear reactors thus remain the only known long-lived, compact source able to supply military space forces with the kind of multi-megawatt power they're going to need. Larger versions of these nuclear reactors in space could meet the multi-megawatt needs of things like space-based lasers, neutral particle beams, mass drivers, and rail guns. Nuclear reactors must support major bases on the moon until better options yet identified are found. So here we find now the complete nuclearization and weaponization of space. A conjunction of interests at work: the Department of Energy, NASA, the Pentagon, the aerospace industry, nuclear academia, all coming together to promote this nuclearization and weaponization of space. So here we have then this full page ad by Lockheed Martin in Aviation Week in Space Technology about a year and a half ago. And they say this: mission. Space is called the final frontier, but these days it's also called a business. So every mission points in two directions at once: toward future opportunity and today's bottom line. They say, we'll take you to the future. And friends, I think it's one of the few times they're being honest with us. They're taking us to the cleaners, I'd say. So we are working hard. For the last year and a half, I traveled 2 to 3 weeks out of the month all over the United States and around the world, talking to people, organizing. I just spent a week in New Mexico. They had a big conference, Space Nuclear Power Conference in Albuquerque, and we had 3 days of protests there. I traveled the state beforehand in order to talk to people and bring them down for the protest. And so that's what we do. Last October 7th, we had an international day of protest. We had demonstrations in 16 countries at 65 locations, mostly at these facilities that I pointed out to you around the world, and also at U.S. embassies and aerospace industry facilities. And this coming October 13th, we're having our second international day of protest against the militarization of space. So I ask you to help us in any way you can. We're having a national space organizing conference. As I go around the country, people, especially in these communities where this work is going on, we think it's important that we all come together frequently to share with each other about the work that's going on in our communities, learn from one another, but also to inspire each other. And so we're going to Huntsville, the place where the Nazi rocket scientists first created the space program, and that where they do 70% of the work on national missile defense. So we're going there in March. And I hope you all might consider sending someone from this community down there to that conference to be part of that.
That was Bruce Gagnon, National Coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. You can visit them on the web at www.space4peace.org. That's space, the numeral 4, peace.org, or call area code 352 352-337-9274. That's 352-337-9274. Or email globalnet@mindspring.com. We'll conclude the program with a piece of good news from Massachusetts proving that not everyone is on the death bandwagon. This is from the March 13th edition of the Boston Globe, written by Globe correspondent Aaron McVeigh. Death penalty bill soundly defeated. The Massachusetts House yesterday defeated a bill to reinstate the death penalty by a margin that surprised most advocates and opponents. The 92-60 vote, after just 3 hours of debate, differed greatly from previous years, when lawmakers engaged in lengthy emotional battles over the issue. In 1997, the bill was defeated by one vote, after a lawmaker switched his position in the last moment. "That's a pretty big margin," said Governor Paul Cellucci after yesterday's vote. "Certainly, the Speaker has made this a priority not to pass the death penalty." Cellucci, who opposed the death penalty as a legislator, has been a vocal advocate of capital punishment as governor. But with support for the death penalty slipping among the public, as doubts emerge about the guilt of some of those sentenced to die, he took a far less active role this year. Yesterday, after the House action, he refrained from harshly attacking opponents or chiding them for being soft on crime. Cellucci even declined to testify 3 weeks ago when the Criminal Justice Committee held public hearings on the legislation. He also did not send Lieutenant Governor Jane Swift. The wider margin occurred in part because new legislatures replaced death penalty supporters. Also, some legislators, such as Democratic Representatives Robert Correa of Fall River and Colleen M. Gary of Dracut, switched sides. "I was surprised the margin was that wide," said Correa. "No one expected it to be a close call, but a 32-vote margin on the vote showed that there were a substantial number of members like myself. The defeat by the House yesterday means the measure cannot be brought up again until 2003. Correa cited his diminished confidence in the criminal justice system as a factor in his decision to abandon the death penalty. Massachusetts is one of 12 states without a death penalty statute. "We should spend the money on programs to make the streets safer and look to prevent murders rather than take out revenge after the fact," said Gary, adding that the testimonies she heard as a member of the Criminal Justice Committee influenced her switch. "I'm not happy about it, but it's not a surprise to me," said House Minority Leader Francis L. Marini, a Republican from Hanson. "We knew exactly what the size of the vote was going to be." He added that as long as he is in the legislature, the debate will continue to resurface. Finneran said the large margin reflected nationwide trends. In Illinois, which has had a capital punishment statute since 1977, more inmates have been released from death row because of doubts about their guilt than have been executed. DNA evidence and confessions from other people prompted many of the releases. Last year, Governor George Ryan halted all executions indefinitely. Marini attributed the margin to a number of forces, including that newer House members tend to be more liberal and that media attention is focused on people on death row who have been later shown to be innocent. Finneran said the vote showed an extraordinary movement away from the death penalty, even in the midst of tragedies such as the killing of 7 office workers in Wakefield. And that was from the March 13th edition of the Boston Globe. The music used in today's program was "Whitey on the Moon" by Gil Scott-Heron. Special thanks to Neil Mather and Radio Cognito of Toronto for their tape on the Space for Peace Summit.
Our theme music, "Unwelcome Guest," is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. "Unwelcome Guests" is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. To help the